Hi, everybody. Welcome to the containment unit. This is Janine Melnitz. What can I do for you?
Put on your bunny slippers. It's slime for the Ghostbusters Containment Unit podcast with your hosts, Matt and Tom.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and ghouls, welcome to another episode of the Containment Unit. I am your friend, Matthew Sanders, and as always, I am here with one Thomas Henry. Tom, how are you today, man?
Hello, I am here. We are quickly running away from our schedule of an episode every week, but we made it. I'm so glad we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby.
Yeah, you know, we had a week off.
We did.
Having some time, having a little vacation. And I would imagine as we, at least until Ghostbusters Day, maybe another week off somewhere in between as things are still a little bit slower.
Yeah,
but it's okay. People, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fine. You know, there's not much to talk about. It's not like there's anything huge happening in the group or anything huge that happened in the group. Yes, it did.
Just a couple few signings.
Yeah, it's been exhausting since we got back from the tournament. There's been a lot going on. I think all the Billy stuff is out now, except the stuff I'm holding on to, which is good. But
like mine, but you know that's cool.
Yeah, your stuff did not make it into that wave. It didn't even occur to me to put them in the box with that painting. That didn't even cross my damn mind. So,
but it's all good. But we had another big signing happen, and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it.
We're going to talk about it. Paul Rudd signing happened.
It's happened.
It's happened.
It's done.
It's done. That's it, folks. Good night. So as of today, as of the moment we're recording this, everyone who made it in, the lucky few, they have seen their items. We have seen our items, of course. It didn't go as 100% as expected. I think that's fair to say. Would you say that?
Yeah, you know, it's almost as quick as this signing came. Nothing went as planned or expected. No. And that's true not only with the lead up and the preparation and the will it happen, will it not happen, but it happened. It was also true in regards to how the signing was completed. So
yeah, it came together very quick and all that. And I, again, like we're really sensitive to like privacy and details and stuff. So I'll say this much. The signing happened in his trailer between takes or setups or whatever you want to call it on a project that he was working on. And, he was very gracious to make time to do it, but he didn't have a ton of it. Character name, quotes, all that was out the window. Didn't even switch a pen. And you know, the headache is that, you know, we had a big old stack of 8x10s, and he went through them very quickly, and he ended up smearing a bunch of them. And,
now, Tom, I know that you're Mr. Hollywood.
Yeah.
You've got some film background. You know that you live like in the Mecca for films. I don't. I'm guessing he probably in a trailer, you don't have much writing surface.
Yeah, I mean, he had a little table, but...
not to the point where he's going to sign and sit one, right. The other one next to it. It's sign and then stack it, right?
Yeah. And it's funny because I got him through the mail years ago when he was doing a Broadway play, and that was also smeared in the same way. So it's kind of his MO. Like, he just signed and then they were stacked on top of each other. And so a bunch got smeared. And in the moment, you know, you have a decision to make. It's do you say, all right, guys who paid money for this, here's your smeared signature or what? So every photo that was smeared, signature was wiped off. And Mr. Rudd was asked to re-sign them. And in a couple cases, you know, if you've ever wiped an inscription off of a photo or whatnot, you know, sometimes there's lines on the photo where the signature was because they pressed too hard with the marker. And so a couple have that issue, but we couldn't reprint. There was no time. And so you make a judgment call and you go with what you think's the best option. And the signatures look great, the re-signatures, but there's some issues with, you know, noticeable removal. And so I kept the worst one. You kept the second worst one. And then, you know, we've let everyone know that, you know, if there was an issue, we let everybody know. It's kind of out of our control. It's not to say they look bad. It's just unfortunate. It's just a thing that happened.
The way I'm choosing to look at it is my photo was signed twice.
Yeah. And sometimes three times. If you look at the back of the photo and you see a splotch of blue ink, that was a Paul Rudd signature at one point.
So for the price of one autograph, we got three. I'm not complaining about that.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, I posted my poster in the group. I got him on that because I had my poster on hand, obviously. And yeah, I'm glad it's over. Ain't happening again. Not through us anyway. So yeah, that's done. I'm waiting on supplies right now, and then I got to travel next week. So, you know, I pride myself on having a very quick turnaround with shipping. You know, usually by the time we announce the signing's over, I think within a week, usually everything's shipped out. And it isn't going to happen this time because I have some travel coming up for work, my normal job. But everything's safe and sound, and we'll get them out as soon as we can.
Absolutely. And so along with that, a couple other updates on signings. So Eldo Rey Estes, that signing is done, and items have all been sent back. And for those of you who requested that they come back with other items, your Eldo items are sitting with Tom. And then Laura Summer, that signing is done. And I should have them in hand at some point this week. And I will do my best to turn those around quickly to get them back out so that we are all caught up on all signings that we have offered. So I'm excited to get those in, check them out, and get them out.
So Matt, so those three signings are wrapped up. 2021, here we are, middle of May. We've done a ton of signings so far this month, this year. So mm-hmm. What comes next?
It's summertime, Tom. I think you and I deserve a little bit of a summer vacation.
Yeah.
So plus I know I'm busy. I'm traveling a lot this summer for work. You're traveling a little bit for work and pleasure.
I am.
And so I think if it's up to me, we're going to hit pause on some signings until probably the fall.
Yeah, so we have Randy Cook, which is outstanding. We're hoping to get that booked in the next couple months. My expectation is it's going to happen during the summer. Now that California's opening June 15th and we're vaccinated and whatnot, hopefully we can get that going. We'll open it up for orders again for those who haven't ordered, and plus we've grown pretty significantly since that happened. And so Randy's next up. We have commitments from others, but we're going to pause on those until a little later. There's a couple things that we're working on, and hopefully if those happen, we will do them. But we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, I think that's, I would say, of course, we've always got our exceptions. So Randy Cook, I'm just ready to get that signing done. People have had stuff sent and being held on to for quite a while. They've been extremely patient. So I think it'll be great to get that done. But you and I did send some offers out on a couple. And if they take, I'm vacation. That's yesterday's news. I'm ready to get these signings done.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
So, and I think I'm not going to give anything away, but I think people would be really excited about these signings if they happen.
Yeah. They are afterlife related.
Ooh.
But they're also maybe related to something else. But we're not going to talk about it.
We're not talking about it.
We're not saying the names, but we're working on it. Hopefully they come to
pass. We're not trying to get hopes up right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we have commitments for the projects and Boss Film, and we got to get them on there. But Yeah, we just need to take a bit of a breather. I have a lot of stuff going on, and Matt as well in our lives, and so we're just going to take a siesta. The group will still be here, and we'll probably still do this podcast, but just like the signings take a lot of work, and we've been working at a pretty fast clip, so we're just gonna.
Just hitting pause for a little bit.
Pause for a little bit. Doesn't mean we're not doing signings. We have plenty of signings coming up, and they're just not time sensitive, so we can do them pretty much whatever.
Yeah, because like you said, the group is still going. Come this time next month, there'll be a lot to be talking about. We'll have been talking about a lot for several days at this point.
Oh yeah.
There's still a lot of good Ghostbusters fun to be had.
Yeah, and I might offer a thing to the group. I haven't decided. We can talk about it here. I don't care. It's public. But there's a thing in LA called Stranger Con, and Finn Wolfhard is going to be at this convention, and it's going to be my first convention since COVID. And I tried to do a signing with him attached to the convention that was going to happen in July, but they told me no, because Finn's basically sold out is what they said. Now, that was a few weeks ago, and you and I quickly bought the autograph tickets for the items that we need. As of today, he's still available. So if they're up, I don't know, a month from now, then I'll probably offer that to anybody I can help at the show. But
am I really about to buy another ticket for Finn Wolfhard?
I wouldn't. What do you need him on besides?
That Mother's Day shot is so good, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to wait and see what Ghostbusters Day brings. If there's a trailer and there's a new shot, then maybe.
Good call. Good call. I support that decision 1,000%.
So if you're listening to this and you need Finn Wolfhard and you're like, oh my God, how can I get Finn? Shoot us an email. Don't message me unless I know you personally. But send us an email, and I can help you out on a one-off. I don't mind helping a couple people, and then I'll take care of it for you.
Well, there you go.
I'll just charge you a nominal fee for my time.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice because there's been a couple of shows announced here in Orlando, almost back-to-back in August. We've got MegaCon and then Fanboy Expo Orlando. And there's some pretty great guests at Fanboy Expo Orlando that I'm excited about. And people are asking me for help again, which I don't mind doing that. And I don't like to charge a whole lot for it. But if it can pay for my ticket, I'm glad to do that too. But I'm just excited that we're having these conversations again. It just feels good.
At MegaCon.
MegaCon? Yeah. I'm on the hook for some hobbits, aren't I?
Just the one, but I need a quote from him. Like, you need to do whatever you did to Anthony Daniels, you need to do it to this guy, because, like, I need it.
We've not talked about that on this podcast, how I buttered up Anthony Daniels so hard.
So you need to butter up Don Monahan so he writes this lyric on my album.
Is that hard? I don't know. Is he not?
I have no frame of reference, so I don't know. I've not met him. There's somebody at Fanboy that I thought I needed too. Is that the one with Ed Begley Jr.?
Well, he's at their Knoxville show.
No.
I would love to meet Ed Begley Jr. I love him for more than just Ghostbusters.
He's at the Hollywood show frequently. Also, you know who's at the Hollywood show is Lou Gossett Jr. from Jaws.
Ooh, I need him. I need him on a Jaws 3D, the superior Jaws sequel. And I need him on a card.
Well, I'm going in August, taking Jay to our first con.
Is he there for sure?
Yeah, he's on the list.
Okay. Yeah, let me see. They just had, like, we just got announced that Matt Lanter and Ashley Eckstein from the Clone Wars will be there. If that gets you excited, you know.
Nothing could excite me less than that.
Come on, man. But no, for me,
no disrespect.
You know, the other group that I'm I admin and kind of help lead with some friends of ours, mutual friends, is a Disney autograph group. And they've got a bunch of Disney people up in that house too that I'm excited about. Plus, my girl Claudia Wells from Back to the Future. I've not met her yet, and I need her. So,
can I even, like? Yeah, she swindled me once. Should I say that on the podcast? I don't know.
But she swindled you?
Yeah, she did. I went to her store, and she conned me into buying a shirt. I was just there for the autographs, which I had to pay for, by the way. But then she conned me into buying this dress shirt that she said was a designer. I didn't recognize the brand. Not that I'm... I mean, look at me. But it was like $60. $60 for the shirt.
For a secondhand used shirt?
Yeah.
$60? Was it Gucci? No, Louis Vuitton?
It was not.
Burberry?
No, that rings a bell. I can't remember, but, you know.
G-Unit? Yeah. Sean John?
It was Sean John. Yeah, it was a picture me and Sean John.
So those are the updates that we got on signings. And so, again, in all seriousness, if you're interested in Finn Wolfhard, make sure you send Tom an email.
If you message me, I'm going to ignore you. Just saying.
Yes. The Ghostbusters Containment Unit at gmail.com. Get on that ASAP. And let me just say that while we're at it, if you are not in our group, make sure you find the GB Containment Unit on Facebook and join our community. Join in on the fun. And you can follow us on Instagram as well. But Tom, let's get to the other segment that I'm a big fan of. That is it for our signing updates. Let's get into our next topic. One of our favorites. We talk about it as often as we can. But this segment is called The Mailbag.
The mail's here.
All right, so Tom, have you gotten anything fun in the mail back?
Yes. Am I going first?
Ooh. I can talk about my thing. You can talk about your thing. Although one of my things leads into another one of your things.
I'll go with mine. Yours is probably better. But I've gotten a bunch of stuff. I've gotten a bunch of stuff in the mail lately. So autograph wise, through the mail, I've gotten 3 back. Lately that I sent out. But here's the thing. So one of them I sent out like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and it was Michael Ensign. And it was on one photo, and he wrote a quote on it. You know, I won't pay it. So that was cool. Literally took a week.
I hate you.
But then there was one that I sent, I think back in October, probably, to Kyle McLaughlin from Twin Peaks. I love Twin Peaks. Anybody who's ever met me knows that I love Twin Peaks. And I sent him 2 11x14 photos, and one of those was already signed by Laura Dern, so I'm rolling the dice. And then I sent a Funko Pop, which I don't really do pops, but I have every Twin Peaks Funko Pop signed except this one. But it's a 2-pack from Comic-Con, and it was Laura Palmer and Dale Cooper. And it was already signed by Laura, so I sent that to Kyle too. And so I sent these 3 items and got them back, and they're perfect. He drew a little coffee cup on the pop. It's amazing. A little cup of coffee. And then he did character name on one of them. And so, yeah, now I need a couple more Twin Peaks signatures. I need David Lynch again, which is no easy feat. And then I need Cheryl Lee. But it was cool to get those back. I didn't know if it was going to happen. But Kyle's been historically really good through the mail. And I decided to take the risk. And I had one more through the mail. Oh, yeah, I sent 2 years ago. I checked. It was 2 years ago I sent this photo. And the actor's name is Kevin Teague. And you may not recognize his name, but he had a big career in TV in the 70s. What I know him from is from Lost. And on the TV show Lost, he played John Locke's father. So he's a big character. He's a key piece of the show. And he lives in the middle of nowhere in Washington State. And I sent this thing like 2 years ago, and I never thought I'd see it again. But it came back a couple days ago, which is pretty amazing because I had no idea what it was. And it was just, it was fun. It was a fun surprise.
Those long lost, forgotten returns are some of my favorites. 2 years is a long time.
It is. Yeah, it was literally early 2019 that I sent it. And then I made a purchase. I haven't done a whole lot hobby-wise lately. I've been busy. But when we were, you know, we talked about last episode, we talked about kind of the the deflating time at the Murray Brothers tournament. But we were in the hotel one day, and I was looking through eBay, and I just happened across this listing, and it was a an original Ghostbusters 1 script. And I kind of impulse bought it, but then reached out to a friend of ours, and that person was like, yeah, it's legit. And then I got the story behind it. So it's a first draft, which with air quotes, because it's not actually the first draft, but it's probably like the first production draft. And it was owned by a guy who worked for a company that did the product placement in the movie. So he was responsible for saying, hey, let's put this Diet Coke can on the Ecto-1 or whatever it was. And it was his script. And it is definitely from 1983. So I have an original copy of a Ghostbusters 1 script, which is kind of cool because it matches my original copy of my Ghostbusters 2 script.
No, it's pretty awesome. Have you sat down and gone through all the notes on it yet?
I have not. No, it's in a baggie sitting on a shelf right now. I just like the look of it, you know. It's kind of fun, and I don't know what I'll do with it ultimately, but...
Well,
but it was worth it.
At this point, your Ghostbusters script collection, until we get Afterlife, I mean, it's pretty complete. Yeah. Unless you're trying to get that 2016 script too, which we could probably make that happen. Well, you know, but in all seriousness, like, I know that there's not a lot of concept art from that film because it was all digital. So I wonder, you know, how these newer films, there's still got to be hard printed, hard copy scripts. Right?
Yeah, they're asking. So you're talking for Afterlife?
No, I'm talking about for 2016.
Oh, yeah.
There's not a lot of concept art out there because it's all digital.
Don't you own concept art?
Yes and no. I mean, this was Hank Mayo's suggestions. It was almost like an audition type thing to get to get on the film, but it was not accepted. So I don't, it's like, is it official concept art? I don't know. But outside of that, I've seen a lot of the concept art. You can tell someone has drawn it up on an iPad or other computer, but anyhow, no, I do not have a Ghostbusters 1 script. I've got two Ghostbusters 2 scripts. Maybe I can somehow trade that for a 1 script somewhere, somehow. But that's a cool pickup. That's a cool pickup. Now, for me, so I did something I've never done before. I've never participated in an auction before outside of eBay. And so I was notified that there was an auction that was all the belongings of a former ILM employee named Carrie Nordquist. Carrie worked on many films. And so there were items from all the different cast and crew gifts from these films. So there were shirts that said Revenge of the Jedi. So for a lot of you who are Star Wars fans, you may not know that name because ultimately it was called Return of the Jedi. They changed it last minute, but he had a lot of shirts that said Revenge of the Jedi. Those are very desirable. He worked on some Indiana Jones films. He worked on Howard the Duck. He worked on a few other things, including Ghostbusters 2. So there were a few items that he had listed from his personal collection that were gifts to him that I bid on and won in an auction. So one is a jacket that, if you follow me on Facebook, you can see in my profile picture. I'm in love with this jacket. It's a little too small, but I'm losing weight just so I can fit into this jacket. And then the other thing is a cast and crew watch, which I just wore it to work the other day. I don't think it's ever been worn before because I had to peel off a sticker that says Made in Japan on the back. But yeah, it works. The hand's ticking. And
Matt, all the best stuff is made in Japan.
I'm not questioning that, Tom. I believe it.
That was a legit OG Back to the Future 3 reference. So it works. You set the time.
But the time is very hard because there's no tick marks around the side. So there's no numbers. There's no lines. It's just a white face with the Ghostbusters 2 logo.
Yeah, I think you and I talked about this, like, because you were looking at another one of those wear that mm-hmm. thing. Like, yeah, it's a crew gift or whatever, but wear it. It's a watch. That's an awesome watch to wear. Maybe not wear it every day, but like, yeah, you should wear that thing.
Yeah, I wore it the other day, and you know, I don't mind saying I only paid like $50 for the watch.
Yeah.
So it's not, I know that it's worth more. I got a good deal, but I'm not too scared to wear it because of that.
Right. Like if I had, you know, somehow been lucky enough to purchase a Ghostbusters 2 crew jacket that fit me perfectly, I would have worn that.
Yeah, for some special occasions and whatnot. I suppose you'll get an option to do that again here soon.
Yeah. Yeah, there'll be an option, all right.
So that was fun. I've never, and so that's all new to me, buyer premiums and paying all these other fees that go into auctions like this. So if you guys have never done it, depending on the auctions, you bid on the item and you have your final price plus, like, I think this one was an extra 10% and just buyer's premiums that you add on top of the item. So it adds up quick, but I still got, I think, a good deal on everything. And I was really excited because I'm a huge Ghostbusters 2 fan. So I love that. Then the other thing I got in is an original art piece by the William Bryan, Tom. And you helped me acquire that.
I did.
I mean, we, in our interview with Billy, he talks about his art show, and you and I went on the website that he told us about, and we checked out all the different pieces, but you went to the art show.
I did.
The art walk, right? Is that what it's called?
Well, yeah, sort of. Yeah. They used to do an art walk in Long Beach, but I guess a couple years ago it changed. And so it's not so much of a, like, they closed the street art walk, but the gallery, Bill has a showing this month at the gallery, and you can go in and see his art. There's all kinds of paintings and sculptures and stuff. He has amazing stuff. And then on the weekends, he's been coming out with his band and playing music on the street. You know, and they had, you could buy beer and stuff. It was a good time. It was awesome.
So he's a maker of movie magic. He's a painter, sculptor, musician. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does the guy not do?
He's very talented. And, you know, I can say this, with no hyperbole, that it was one of the best times I've had in a long time. And, it was a very cool event. And, yeah, it was, the little sweetheart I was with, made a lot of friends there, and, it was a very memorable experience for a bunch of people.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. And I know it meant the world for Billy to have you show up there and for us to purchase his art. And it's fun for me because, you know, we talked about this from the beginning of the containment unit. It's not about just using cast and crew to get their autographs for our collection. It's about really supporting these guys and girls and getting to know what they're passionate about and supporting that. And so for us to be able to contribute, and we each bought a painting, and it was really cool. And you got to see him perform live, which is, I got a quick video clip, but.
Yeah, he did. One of his songs is pretty funny. I mean, he's got a bunch of songs. There's one moment that I thought was pretty good. He does his resume rap, and we specifically talked about it on the interview. And right before he did that, he was talking to the crowd, and he goes, "Okay, now I'm gonna rap my resume." And he looks at me and he goes, "Okay, it's gonna start. It's gonna start like right." He was giving me the heads up so I could record it, which I did. But we were kind of far away, and the audio quality is not that great. But you can check it out on YouTube. You know, the Billy Bryan resume rap. It's out there, and yeah, it's, you know, if you ever have an opportunity, Bill plays with his band a lot. His band's great. They are great guys, and Bill is just a great individual, and he's so damn talented. His art is not just the paintings of Stay Puft. There's so much mm-hmm. other stuff, and he puts such care and thought into what he paints, and it was just really, really cool, and I'm glad that I was able to go, and and have that special evening, and I'm glad it was memorable for him too in some way.
Yeah, and I would say if you don't follow Bill on Facebook, make sure you do, because I know that they're performing live again, I think maybe this weekend. So for those of you who are listening, it's probably too late, but it seems like they do it pretty regularly with this art and all that in Long Beach. So if you want to check them out, just keep tuned into his Facebook page. I know he posts about it. So the last thing we want to talk about, Tom, before we get into the interview, is from one friend to another. The interview this week is with Mark Brian Wilson. And you just, again, you talk about a very talented, multi-talented, sweet guy. Mark Brian Wilson, man. That's who he is. That's who he is.
Yeah, and I, Mark has not, he's, he to us, and I don't mean this in like a braggy way, but Mark is our friend. He's not, and he is Slimer, and he has an amazing career, and he did a lot of stuff, but to us, Mark is a friend first, and he's just a great guy. He's an honorary member of our team. He's our, what did we call him? Consultant. He's our consultant, yeah. On the Boss Film Project, and he's just one of the nicest guys, and he's so generous with his time with fans, and he really, loves his history, and he loves the movies, and he loves puppetry, and he's just very passionate about the things that he loves, and got mad respect for that.
Absolutely. And so what you're about to hear in just a moment is our interview with Mark Brian Wilson before our first signing with Mark. He is a name that we are going to see again here soon. So if you missed out, don't stress, don't worry. After our summer break, that is a name that we'll be getting, in the months to come. This is a great conversation. We get into a lot of detail about Slimer, how he's made, and all that. And so I think for those of you who don't know any of this information, you'll find it really informative and really cool.
Agreed.
And then this signing was a fun one for you because it was a COVID signing.
It was.
That happened outside in the front yard.
Yeah, we ended up hanging out in his front yard for a bit, just chatting, and it was a good time. You know, COVID made it hard to do these signings. We did a miraculous number of them, I'm going to say, given the circumstances. And what is it? We're recording this. It's May 19th, so... less than a month from now, California's open, no mask mandate, and things appear to be getting pretty good out there. And so we hope that future signings will be a little less challenging. But yeah, it's crazy. Looking forward to not having to wear the mask and hand sanitizer and all that stuff.
Absolutely. So with that, let me just remind you, as always, don't be a peck, all right? Be like Mark Brian Wilson. Be a nice person and someone that people like to be around, and enjoy this conversation with Mark Brian Wilson.
Mark, thank you for joining us today. We're so excited to have you.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it. And hey, I hope we get to talk about Ghostbusters.
I think there's a good chance of that.
Oh, good.
A new topic.
Yeah, it was an amazing project, so I'm always happy to talk about it.
So I think for me, Mark, the first thing I would love to know, because I know that you have some puppeteering experience and marionettes. For those of us who are at the in-house con, we got to see you put on a little demonstration for us. We know that you are a skilled craftsman with the making of molds and stuff like that. So how did you get started? Where did you get your start?
Most of my start was on my own. When I was about five or six at school, I saw a marionette show. And after the marionette show, which was really awe-inspiring for me as a little boy to see a live performance, we got to go behind the proscenium and see all of the puppets. So that kind of got me looking and learning. I started to get some books in school. I built some stuff in high school. But then when I went into college, I started meeting other people who had built marionettes, and that gave me a chance to ask, how do you do that? How do you make a mold? How do you make a two-part mold? What kind of clay do you use to sculpt with? Because everything I was doing, you know, back in the 1960s and 70s, of course, there was no internet. There was no YouTube. And so books, I went to the library even at my elementary school and picked out some books. And you could see how to do a very rudimentary model or a mold or, how to sculpt a human head and get the shapes in the right places. And so that kind of got me all started. But I guess when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I started running into people who knew how to do all that stuff professionally. One of my first mentors was Frank Paris, who was a marionette builder, performed at places like Radio City Music Hall, and quite a great craftsman. His marionettes were fantastic. So I started hanging out with him. He was building a show at the time, and I helped him make molds because he would show me and to do a little sculpting and also to just work on that stuff. So it just went from there. Eventually, I got a job. My first worked at Magic Mountain in California as a prop builder for the street theater program. Learned a lot of stuff there. A guy there, Paul, was a mold maker who had worked at Don Post Studios. And they're a major mask making company. And at that point, they were like the latex mask making company in the world. So I learned how to do plaster molds, slip casting latex, a lot more fabrication. And some of the stuff I learned actually, when I was a little kid, I asked my folks, and my father was a woodworker. My mom would help me with the costumes. My brother was a model maker, so he had the airbrush and some other stuff like that. And then my sister also helped with the costumes. So it was, just occasionally I would bring them in. Usually it was a one-man show. But just, I had to learn. Once I had seen what marionettes look like, there was that magic. And I thought, there's something there I need to know more about. How come they look so alive? What is that thing that's right there in front of me? And how can I learn more about that? And I'm still bit by that bug today. I have a marionette collection, which in one jump went from about 5 marionettes up to 65. So I now have a very large marionette collection, all of them professional stuff, including I have the Howdy Doody from the work with Jim Carrey, as when he was supposed to be Andy Kaufman. So I've got some really cool puppets. And I take a marionette out and I begin to work it, and I still feel that magic. And I think that's what really got me into the film industry, was my love for doing this stuff and to the making of something and then bringing it to life. I mean, there's something really magical about that, and not just for an audience, but to put it on film. Mm-hmm. Once that is preserved, then it can be replayed over and over and over again. And so to go back and watch any of the stuff that I've worked on, from Ghostbusters, Fright Night, Poltergeist 2, Big Trouble Little China, Hook, Men in Black, so I have a pretty long career, but it was always to get to see that stuff come to life on screen and to sit in a full house at a movie theater and just to see people react to something that I did so many years ago. But of course, when we build a movie puppet, we build it a lot more detail. We can spend more time, bigger budgets, a lot more people would be working on any of the stuff on Ghostbusters. Half a dozen to a dozen people on each character would have different jobs at different times. And the puppet gets passed around the workshop so that different people do their specialties, the mechanics or the puppet builders or foam casters, mold makers. So I got to, at that point when I was in the film industry, really got a chance to learn from some of the world's best. To see how to make a 27-part mold instead of a 2-part mold, to see what it takes to make things so they can be reproduced over and over and over again to the highest quality if possible. So I just, short answer, I got started. I couldn't stop. I'm still learning, So it's a great hobby. It's a great way to make a living. When it's there, it's not always there. It's kind of an interesting way to make a living because in the 80s, of course, it was a high demand. No computer graphics. People needed to bring characters to life. So in order to do that, we had to build them. Of course, starting in the 90s up to today, a lot more characters can be done in the computer. And I love what they're doing. I hear a lot of people go, it's not a real puppet. The things you can do with a computer graphic character and you put 900 people behind it and they work for a year long is pretty amazing. No, we never had a crew like that when we were building a puppet. So it's kind of hard to compare, you know, one to the other, but I love the way computer graphics are going and the things that they can do that we never were able to do. But there is still some magic about a puppet on screen or giving an actor something to act right against there that's three-dimensional, that's in real time. So great stuff. Yeah.
Wait, was that a conscious decision that you made throughout your career where you decided one day, like, movies are for me? Or was it something that just kind of right place, right time? Like, how did you initially break into the film industry?
It helped a lot, I think. And I can't say that it was everything because I had to work hard and develop my talents. But luck, being the right place, right time. I was raised in Southern California. So 45 minutes from Hollywood. And now where I live, I'm about 15 minutes. So I was raised pretty close to the area. I got to see people working on films in my neighborhood. They shot Christine out in the New Hall area and they blew up the car and, you know, all this stuff was in the local paper. So to me, it wasn't, you know, way over there. It was in my neighborhood. There was a couple of people that I knew that worked in the industry. So I kind of felt like I had a chance just by being close. After I left Magic Mountain, I went ahead and tried to find companies that were doing TV commercials, monster movies. I was looking into creature shops and stuff like that. So as a young person, I would get the magazines, Famous Monsters of Filmland, Starlog, Cine Fantastique. I think were probably the biggest ones at the time. And then I would see names in those and think, ooh, you know, Rick Baker, he's really cool. Look, you know, he's this hippie guy with this long hair, and he's just making this great art. I'm going to grow up and be Rick Baker. So that was kind of where I set my goals, although I don't know that I ever thought as a youngster that this was going to happen. This is who the guy I'm going to work with. And lucky enough that I got a chance to work with Rick on several projects. So kind of a childhood dream come true. But it was always, I want to play and continuing to do this stuff. As I got older into high school and college, my father sat me down and said, hey, son, you know, it's time to get a serious career. Have you considered something where you could get into a union and where you can get your benefits and you can get regular hours? And I thought, but I want to be a puppeteer. So it was always kind of a, you know, if a door was offered, you know, or somebody said door one or two, I would say, well, which one has the puppets behind it? And I'll go that direction. So I guess consciously, I never thought of doing anything else. But I don't know that I ever, you know, as a youngster said, I'm going to work in the movies. It was just, it always interested me, you know, everything about it, behind the scenes stuff. If you'd see it in the movies or on TV, which was really rare back then, you know, I would just glue myself to the TV set and learn everything I could about a puppet for the movies. And then I guess when I was in high school and college, Rick's work on Star Wars, American Werewolf in London. And so immediately I saw, puppets, masks, makeup. It's not just makeup, but they need people to, you know, make this stuff move around. They needed to bring it to life. So I think for all that, it just, the lights kept going on. You know, it's like, I want to do that, you know, and even I think I just thought of it more as a hobby. I can't stop learning. I want to make another monster mask. Hey, it's almost Halloween, you know, so it was always, you know, I was doing something special for Halloween. I think even as early as 10, I took a cardboard box and built it over my shoulders, put on a large bathrobe so I could become a headless guy, you know, cut a hole in the middle and pin the robe open just a little bit. You know, so I was always looking for ways to use the human form in different ways, to be imaginative, to be creative. And that stuff is always the stuff that lit me up. And once I got into the film industry, luckily there was, you know, a job and then another job and then another job. And it was able to keep me going. So once I was into the industry, you know, there was some big breaks, but luckily, the other breaks were that I was getting to work and getting to meet people that would give me additional jobs. And yeah. I met a lot of nice people and had a lot of creative experiences. So I'm glad I did, you know.
You mentioned a few small films you worked on, like Men in Black and Poltergeist.
Yeah.
But let's kind of get into Ghostbusters a little bit. How did you get connected to that film? What was the process, and how did you get started there?
I guess I had already worked for Rick Baker on Thriller, and he had just come back from Greystoke, and one of his crew members was Steve Johnson. Rick came back. I had already met Kevin Brennan. And so I had made some connections of some of the people on Rick's crew. And then when Rick got back into town, by then I had already worked a little bit for Doug Beswick. So all of these were building kind of connections of other people that Steve Johnson knew. So when Steve started his project, he called me to bring in my portfolio. And I was probably one of the first 20 people to show their book to Stuart Ziff and Steve Johnson to try to get a job on the crew. So it was a phone call, you know, hey, bring your portfolio down. We've heard good things. We want to know if you'd like to be part of the project, but come down and show us what you have to offer. And so I grabbed my book, you know, big format photographs in a portfolio, carried it under my arm and went down and sat down and had a meeting and said, you know, this is what I've done to date. Here's the projects that I did at home on the breakfast bar. Here's the projects that I did for Magic Mountain. Here's the projects I did on One Dark Night, Monster in the Closet, and some early projects, Thriller by that point. So it wasn't a shoe-in, but when they saw my portfolio, they said, yeah, you know, we definitely need you. We want you. You know, you do a lot with puppets. This is a big puppet project. So I think I maybe started the following Monday or something. You know, so it wasn't very many days. And then we were running like crazy to get all this stuff done.
Yeah. You know, we obviously love Ghostbusters, Mark. That's how you and I met. That's how Matt and I met. You know, I don't want to ask the same questions you always hear about Ghostbusters, but I want to ask this. When you think about your time on the film and you think about Slimer and the library ghost, like, what memory does it trigger for you? Like, what do you think about immediately when someone says Ghostbusters?
Wow. Since it's always in front of me, over the last 10 years and stuff, I've been doing conventions and stuff. It's kind of a big mass of, you know, all that great energy. I'm the proudest, of course, of Slimer, and he has had the most lasting impact. But I was also involved in the Librarian Ghost and the Terror Dogs. To me, probably the biggest impact to me is that body of work. It is a huge amount to accomplish and to get put on the film. And probably of all the projects I worked on, I think I had more of a thumbprint on more projects on that than anything else. So I think instead of it being narrowed down to possibly one character, one moment, it's that massive time in my life. It was so many months between building, performing. Every day was a different project. Every day was a new sculpture, was solving a different problem. So it was a great timing. You know, I was knowledgeable at that point. I was artistic and aesthetic. I loved monster movies, and to step into Ghostbusters, which was a huge budget movie compared to the other ones that I had done, which were pretty small budget, was really phenomenal. So to me, the whole thing is almost like you're running a million miles an hour. There's just all that energy. Those months working together with that amazing crew, I figured there was probably 30, 40 people on the creature crew. Everybody pretty well known and having done lots of projects. So it's such you know, such a big diamond in the ring that I'm proud of the whole process.
So let me follow up on something you said there. You said so for the last 10 years or so you were doing conventions, and we know we've seen you at a couple conventions.
Yeah.
So the 25 years before that, so was Ghostbusters impacting your life in that time too? Was it less, or was it about 10 years ago that it really kind of broke open for you?
About 10 years ago, it started.
Okay.
I think a lot of it has to do with the internet, iPhones, you know, mass communication. Unfortunately, on Ghostbusters, as you know, I didn't get screen credit, so I didn't have every time it's playing, somebody's going to go try to find me in the phone book or something. Once there was the internet and the internet IMDb, then that connected my name, even though it's uncredited, to the movie. So that, you know, helped a lot. And that's only about 10, 15 years ago. I was surprised there was so little. I knew Slimer was popular, and the characters from Ghostbusters. But when I started doing the conventions, that's when I started meeting all the different groups that do the cosplay or do the fundraising, all the franchise groups through Ghost Corps. It really went from 0 to 100 about 10 years ago. I did my first convention. I went to England. So the first time I got to go to England, I got flown over, got a hotel room, got to meet people. They lined up to give me money, you know? And so that was like day one of doing conventions, which was 2007 or something like that. So not all that long ago, and it was really eye-opening. I mean, it's pretty amazing to go to a place and they put you at a table and say, just sit here and people who like you are going to come by. It's like, what? It's really phenomenal, you know, and I always get a rush out of the experience. I wish there was a lot more. I'd love to do a lot more conventions and meet a lot more fans.
Yeah. It's so many people that we've talked to like this. It seems like they're surprised when they learn that people not only want to meet them, but get their signature on a piece of paper or on a photo. Yeah. Like, it just is so bizarre to them. And I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but you said something earlier that I wanted to ask you about too. I would love to hear about your time on Thriller. I mean, there was you, like you said, Rick Baker, Timothy Lawrence, like all these fantastic people are working on that. What was that like?
It was my first chance to work for Rick Baker. So just that by itself was pretty awe-inspiring. And then I guess to show Rick my book, again, carrying around my portfolio. This was before Ghostbusters. But Rick had me come to his house. I met him in his living room. He was wearing cut-off shorts and the sandals with the tire tread. And, you know, he was pretty kicked back. You know, I like Rick. I still do. So he sat in one chair. The great big painting of a gorilla that his father had done for him was over his shoulder. So all the time I'm looking at Rick, I'm looking up at this beautiful rendition of a gorilla. So he went through my portfolio and said, yeah, you know, we'll bring you on. And my first job on Thriller was to help clean up the shop because it had been sitting for a year since they were off on Greystoke. So you get all excited. Oh boy, I'm going to be a monster artist. Here's your broom, son. Take the mop, take the bucket. But actually, the front room that we cleaned up was surrounded with the heads from the Cantina Band, kind of devil character from Star Wars. You know, so I don't even remember the work I was doing. I was in heaven and getting a chance to look at all these amazing things. On Thriller, there was about 10 of us, I think, including Rick, that had separate jobs. Each one of us was given a project to do because there was so many dancers. There were supposed to be about 50 originally. So I was in charge of hands. I did a bunch of slip latex, spandex gloves that were made so that once the actors had their makeup and stuff on, that the gloves could just be slid on instead of doing another 2 hours, 2 hour makeup on 50 performers. So I came up with a way to reproduce the hands, big sheets of foam latex to give texture. Sean McEnroe sculpted fingertips, so all of the hands looked a little longer. And then we just started casting up all these fingertip extensions, added fake fingernails. The big sheets of foam latex had zombie texture stamped in. So I made hand after hand after hand after hand. Eventually, Margaret Vassera, now it's Margaret Prentice, joined and helped paint hands. So I got to work side by side with her for a couple of weeks. And other people, Tom Hester was just a bench behind mine. He was working on the transformation. He was working on, you know, the hand, nail growing and stuff for Michael's transformation. Tim Lawrence was working on some prosthetics. Jack Bricker was there doing teeth one after the other. David Miller ended up being there. Kevin Yeager, even though he wasn't in the shop, just a few doors down, was Greg Canham. And he was doing his own makeup, so we went down to see that, I believe, at one point. But there was, you know, all of these guys doing all of this great stuff. So as you're working on your projects, of course, I'm walking around being the fly on the wall and saying, you know, well, how do you get all that great texture, Tom Hester? Here, I use these texture pads. And he showed me the texture pads he had made for Greystoke. And it was kind enough to allow me to take a copy of those texture pads, which I used for many, many years. Just techniques, you know. Hey, Jack Bricker, you're doing the teeth. What's that all about? And he would show us how to use pressure pots and stuff to get the resin to be denser. And so it was a great learning experience. I mean, it's like being thrown into UCLA makeup school or something, with all of these people who have at least five films under their belt, many of them more than that. So it was a small workshop. Rick outgrew that shop a couple of different times while I was working for him. But it was a great spirit. To be working with all these talents and get to learn. Again, a candy store, instead of being in Famous Monsters from Filmland, there was somebody making fake teeth with four or five different sets and talking about alginate and life impressions. I learned a little bit about life casting there. I had learned some on the previous projects, but a chance to work again with alginate and all that. If you see the making of Thriller, I believe I'm the guy on the stopwatch saying 20 seconds, 30 seconds when they're doing Michael's life cast. So, you know, got a chance to meet Michael Jackson and John Landis. And you know, what a great and fun experience to get to be making zombies, you know, doing all that stuff. And, of course, the highlight of my day was Rick's workbench was not too far from the water cooler. And I developed a strong thirst for both water and information on that. I got a chance to go by and see what Rick was doing. First, he did a series of vinyl acetates, like cell animation of Michael's transformation. First, he was going to be a jaguar or a Black Panther. But that got changed to be more of this jackal character that he ended up being. But I got to, you know, go by, and there would Rick be, you know, painting on the back of a cell and laying it down and doing his two or three different layers of these makeups and stuff. Then, of course, when Rick was sculpting the different aspects of the transformation or Michael Zombie or whatever, I got to see all that stuff done, including when they did Michael's teeth or his appliances. They already had the teeth done so that his lips would get pushed out just the right amount. To give them a bit of dimension, and so that when the sculpture was done over that, that they all fit together and made sense dimensionally instead of pushing everything out and then pushing everything out. And so to me, it was a great education getting to see all of that stuff. And then on set, we got to shoot down in, I think it was Carson, California. But anyway, it's where the Oscar Mayer meatpacking buildings are. So you drive down there through all of this roast pork smell, and then you'd work with zombies all night long. So it was pretty surreal. Yeah. But working night shoots, we shot outdoors. You know, I got to listen to Thriller probably 500 or 600 times. But they do something weird so that you can hear the beat, but you can't really hear the lyrics. So, you know, it's the smell of pork and all the time. So that they could pick the beat. Really surreal. And even while we're there, I mean, Michael's friends would come by, people like Jackie Onassis. I mean, that's a once-in-a-lifetime experience to get to meet people that, you know, are that famous, along with Michael, of course. But Michael was real nice. He was very friendly, enjoyed the process. I always tell other people that he was kind of like a Peter Pan, very lively. He was like, you know, as you start to tell him something, he'd see something else in the workshop and just be so excited that he was working on a zombie picture and getting to be these characters. It was really amazing to get to work with him. And then, of course, the Thriller coming out and being in the theaters and getting the great response, kind of both ways, actually. There's the people who loved it, all the monster makers, but it was also released with Fantasia. So mothers were going, how could you show this with Fantasia? Yeah. It's like, well, you know, Fantasia has, you know, the Chernabog, who is the great demon out of the mountain. And so, you know, it's not really the lightest Disney picture if you look at it. But really a great experience all the way through. including if you look in the theater, when Michael and Ola Ray get up and they're walking out, I'm in the back row. You can see my glasses. We got to be cameos in the theater audience there. Elaine Baker's down in the front and a few of the people that were heads of departments and stuff. But I had a chance to actually be there. So we got to do a bunch of different jobs, including our cameos in makeup. My makeup has never got up all that close because my competition was Kevin Yeager, David Miller, Tim Lawrence. So all of their stuff, you know, when it came down to, you know, Rick had to pick so many for the inside of the apartment when they're coming in at the camera. Darn, you know, mine just didn't step over the line. It was fantastic. I've still got pictures of it, and it's an amazing makeup. So very proud of it, but it didn't get me any more camera time. So if you look, I'm walking down railroad tracks, and I'm doing, you know, some more fill-in work, I guess, you know, but didn't get any of the great close-ups. So.
I don't know about you, Tom, but that we were young when Thriller came out, and that transformation scene scared living daylights out of me. The rest of it didn't bother me. I thought it was fun and whimsical and kind of, but when he turns into that creature at the very beginning, it was terrifying.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And it's really interesting because earlier this week, Matt and I had a conversation with somebody who is a, I don't know, what do you want to call him? A Ghostbusters archivist, I guess. He knows everything there is to know about Ghostbusters. Okay. And I mentioned that you were in Thriller and he had no idea. And so it was like this great revelation to him. And I was like, yeah, he was there in makeup and check his Facebook, his picture of the makeup. And it was just, what's interesting about your career, Mark, and it's something that I live almost daily. You had your hands on so many different things. I was sitting on the couch over the weekend trying to find a movie to watch. I threw on Gremlins 2. It took me about 20 minutes to realize, I was like, wait a minute, Mark worked on this movie. You know, it's like we always see your work, whether it's Beetlejuice or Evil Dead, and you've been all over the place. But there's one movie that I think a lot of our viewers may not know that you had a little bit of a hand in, you worked on for a little bit. And I was hoping you would tell us a little bit about what you did for Ghostbusters 2.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that I worked on two of the films. There's a few people that worked on both, including Mark Siegel, a very good friend of mine who worked in the creature department on both. But after Ghostbusters was at Boss Films, it ended up going up to Industrial Light and Magic, which was a whole different crew. And Tim Lawrence ended up going up there and heading that up. I had brought Tim in on Ghostbusters as a puppeteer for Terror Dogs. I don't know if he did any other building or stuff. I think he was pretty busy over at Rick's at that point. But we were lucky enough to get him to puppeteer. And I always loved working with Tim. He was always very upbeat, and you could see the joy whenever we were doing anything. but I worked, Tim called me to come up to ILM. And Slimer, that was my first thing, is, oh, can I do Slimer? Am I going to? So, oh, well, we're not going to do it. We were going to do it. We started to build a suit. At that point, I think it was shelved. First, they had, I think Bobby Porter was going to be in it. Anyway, nobody was doing Slimer. Okay, what do you got? Well, we want you to come up. We saw your Halloween costume you did a few years ago. Of course, Tim saying this, that, you know, that skeleton you did where it was all kind of in front of your body and then all the movements that you did, it would move also. Yeah, he said, well, we want to do something like that. So we want to put the puppet in front of you almost like Bunraku and slave it off of your movements. So 1 second. We actually built a puppet of the one, the thinnest Scoleri brother. I'm not sure what his name is. You guys probably know. At first, it was going to be a puppet and not a guy in a suit. So see if you can see that. So this was my long hair phase. Yes, that's actually my hair.
Ooh, look at you.
We were doing Renaissance fairs at the time. My wife and I were doing ceramics and stuff. So I kind of went towards the D'Artagnan phase. But this was all slaved off of my body, and anything I would do, he would move. If I would turn my head, he would turn his head. If I would step forward, his feet would step forward. If I would take the rods at his elbows and move them, then he would move forward. So it was a really nifty puppet. And I started on a Monday. I don't live in that area. That's up in Northern California. So I drove up, I think, on the weekend. On Monday, I started to work. Tim gave me the drawings. Bob Cooper joined me as a co-builder. He's a regular. He was in the Creature Cruise up at ILM. So Bobby and I jumped into the foam. I had already bought some of the materials when he started, I think, on Tuesday or Wednesday. Sheets of foam, glued them together, put them around the metal, figured out how to connect the head to build that puppet, and even got a chance on Friday to shoot some tests. Dennis Murin was there, and of course, Dennis Murin is one of the key people over at Industrial Light and Magic, and he was impressed with my work. He said, "I really like the way that's moving. Who's in there?" And I was all dressed in black. The conversations kept on. He said, no, wait, you know, 5 minutes go by. He says, "I want to know who was in that. You know, I really like the movement." So I got a chance to meet Dennis Murin while still dressed in a puppet. And they said, "Okay, that's great. We like that character. Go ahead and we don't have any work for you this week. So why don't you go ahead and go on home and we'll get a hold of you." Excuse me, I get so excited about all this, I get a little dry mouth.
I was going to say, you just like, I'm on the edge of my seat right
now. I forgot what I was talking about. Oh, no. So Dennis Murin liked it a lot, said, "Great, Mark, go ahead and you know, go home, and then we'll contact you for coming back." And I waited and waited and thought, well, that's, you know, it's been a week, I better contact him. Excuse me. So I contacted Tim to find out what was going on. I said, "Oh, well, I think we're going to go a slightly different direction. We've decided that since we're going to stretch their images around, that we don't have to go as thin on the wrists and stuff." So they decided to go with a guy in a suit, and that's where Jim Feig came in. But I thought I was, you know, at least going to get a puppeteer on that. But I got my week.
Hmm.
That's a mind-blowing story, Mark. We had never heard that. You made mention of it earlier this summer, and we were just immediately captivated. You know, Jim's a buddy of ours, and to hear, there's not a lot out there about Ghostbusters 2. It just doesn't really exist. It's not as, I don't know, public as Ghostbusters, I guess. So I really thank you for sharing that story with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, no, most people don't know that I did that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's good that we can get that out there.
Yeah, I love the puppet idea. Just seeing those pictures were really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how they did C-3PO in Star Wars Episode One. They had the puppeteer behind it like that. So very good.
Maybe Dennis Murin stole that idea from you, Mark. You should. We'll have to work on that.
Yeah, for sure. So, Mark, before we go, you know, there's been a lot of conversation around your work on Slimer, you know, a lot with Library Ghosts, but there hasn't been a lot of talk about the Terror Dog. Now, those scared me as a kid. Out of everything in Ghostbusters, the Terror Dog, that is what gave me nightmares. You know, your work and the whole team, Randy Cook, Terry Harden, Tim Lawrence, everybody did so many amazing things. Linda Provost working on these dogs, and I just wanted you to share a little bit about your experience with them. You know, tell us about being on that stage and that set for the climax of the movie.
Yeah, the Terror Dogs were something I wasn't supposed to work on, but I ended up actually putting quite a bit of time in. I was in an office between Randy. He had one window, there was a wall, there was my desk, and then Steve Johnson was behind me. I did a lot of work for Steve. And they kind of passed me back and forth. As soon as I would start to get to work on something, the other guy would say, "Hey, you know, we really need to get this moving ahead. Hey, Mark," you know, which was great. I learned a lot of great stuff. So one of the first things I did on the Terror Dogs was sculpt all the toenails and horns for the full-size puppet. Randy Cook had done the miniature, which was about so big, maybe 18 inches or something like that. But he had already sculpted the miniatures. Of the horns, the claws, the nails, and my first job for Randy was to make all of the duplicates. So I sculpted up a quick horn, I said, "Here it is," and he goes, "Ooh, that's a really nice horn." He was very diplomatic, but that's not really what this one looks like. And I thought, well, it looks like a great, you know, I put this graining and texture, and it looks like a monster-y horn, and he said, "Okay." Just a second, he went and got a Polaroid camera and came back and took a picture of the small horn, so that it was about this big on the Polaroid. And then he took a picture of the large horn, same size in the Polaroid. Remember, this is before digital cameras. So we went through tons of Polaroid pictures. I would photograph each, both the small and the large, top, front, side. And then I would have to duplicate every crease, every nuance, every, you know. So that was my first part of working on the Terror Dogs. While I was matching up all of that stuff, we had, a mock-up of the Terror Dog. Since I was one of the puppeteers, a lot of times they would bring me in and say, okay, get inside and tell us what you think. Okay. So I'd, you know, climb up inside and we'd kind of move things. We'd talk about how it might be working. And this was for the large puppet Terror Dogs, not stop motion. Stop motion is very little. Puppets very big. the large puppets were hollow on the inside. And so the puppet went down and it set on the ground. And we cut a hole up through the table. Or on the set, we cut it through the floor of the set that the Terror Dog is sitting on. And I would climb up inside the hollow body and grab handles on the back of the head. So there's a left and a right, kind of right under their ears. And on the horns, just cut out a ply board with circles. We padded those out. The legs had joints in them like hinges and ropes so that the feet could be held down to the floor. But by moving the head and dropping it down, I could make the dog lean down or raise up. Lars Anderson was our special effects rigger, and he came up with a system with a pipe that went down the spine, down into the floor, about 10 feet to bungee cords. So if a different puppeteer came in, he could loosen up or tighten up those bungee cords to give you more resistance on getting the Terror Dog to lean down. Tighten it up a little bit, it was a little harder. Loosen it up, you could might need more help to keep the Terror Dog in the neutral position. So that's kind of what the first Terror Dogs did. Those were the first couple of puppets that had to be on set. It was before Christmas that year, and I think we started in September. Stage 16, Warner Brothers, the tallest shooting stage in California at that point, and I possibly even at the world at that point, super tall. So the set was up about 6 feet. Then there was the area where the Ghostbusters stood. There would have been the plinths or whatever that the Terror Dogs would have eventually been animated to go on or turned into the statues. then all the steps were acrylic, so they were lit from behind. And this set was huge. So when we came in the first day, you know, you're walking around, but everything's up. And then you had to go around to the back of the set to go up even higher. So the Terror Dogs are about 20 feet up off the ground. And, you know, all of that is just to set construction. So it's 1x2s, 2x3s, 2x4s, you know, some 4x4s to support the whole thing. But it was kind of open. So when we went in to puppeteer that stuff, there was safety harnesses and stuff that we wore and we would clip into. Also inside of those Terror Dogs, we had a little 2-inch Watchman monitor so that we could watch a black and white image of what our camera was seeing. They tried to bring it off of the camera that was shooting, which is usually the best way for a puppeteer. So you can make sure, because you can't see through the puppet's head, you know, is he looking on camera like he's looking at the other character? The master shot, the Terror Dogs were so tiny, we decided that we would like a witness camera. So they put a video camera kind of off to the side and then got that up closer. So I believe each of the Terror Dogs had their own camera. So when Slavica would start to walk over to us, we could react. I'm in the dog in the white shot. You'll see he's got no teeth because there wasn't time to sculpt the teeth, build the mouths, do all of that stuff. So at that point in the long shot, the mouths are closed. To go into the close-up, she reaches down to pet the dog. It's still me in the long shot. She touches it on the head. We cut into the close-up, and that dog's got more teeth than Christmas, you know. And that was shot many months later when they had a chance to do all the teeth, the tongues, the insides of the mouth, the mechanics, the brows that would move, you know. So that was a fully mechanical puppet by that time. So we had kind of a rudimentary puppet that we used for the wide shots. it was, you know, a lot of fun to shoot. We got to kind of meet the guys, but as always, they keep the stars in the dressing rooms until they're ready to roll camera. So a lot of it was done with the lighting doubles and stuff before the cast came out. So we were up in the Terror Dogs. I think we were getting ready to go inside, and we got a wave to, you know, Dan and Billy, and, you know, and the boys. So everybody says, oh, you know, what's it like to work with Bill Murray? And, well, you know, it's, I would have to say he didn't get real close to me. Sorry to say. But, you know, so that you, literally we were 30 feet away from each other, and we did our work, and then they took them off back to their dressing rooms, and we worked for a couple of days, I think, shooting the different angles of the Terror Dogs, looking down at the guys. Now, it's when the dogs are stuck in place. When they're running up the steps, that's a stop-motion Terror Dogs that Randy animated. And it's one dog that they changed the horns on to do the male and then switch them back to the longer horns for the male, male and female, I guess. And so the puppeteers for the Terror Dogs would have been myself. Tim Lawrence would have been on the one, which would have been Vince's character. And Terry Harden and her husband at the time was Ron. So Ron and Terry were on the other Terror Dog, and they switched back and forth occasionally so that Ron got a chance to be on the inside. This, I thought, was going to be my only day puppetry. So I asked Tim if I could remain on the inside, you know. He kind of quivered a little bit, but I said, you know, oh, please, 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 please. This is, you know, because I have to go back and build. And so he did the eyes left and right was his thing. There was a little light bulb in there. If you look real carefully, you can almost see them moving the red eyes. So it was the four puppeteers watching everything on a little tiny monitor. I think Tim probably had a 10-inch monitor on the outside. It was an amazing set, a chance to work on something that was so phenomenal. I remember on one day they were having a little technical difficulties with those doors, but you figure the doors to open up are 20 feet tall, 25 feet tall, and they're on air-driven, kind of a cushion of air, so they could get those massive things to move. So I remember waiting around for those doors to get teched out, whatever it was. They couldn't get the balance quite right. They rigged a line that went up the middle of the stairs to put a light bulb on, which was supposed to be Slavica's character as it's first coming in. You know, it was just basically a light on it, light on a wire. So in some of the shots, I think you can see Robin Williams came to visit in Chevy Chase. And you look behind him and you can see this little tiny wire going up the set. And that's how they rigged that light bulb gag.
Interesting.
So you did this with a Terror Dog. You being on, on set. That was before Slimer, right? So you did Terror Dog before Slimer.
Yeah. At that point, I wasn't scheduled to be Slimer. He had somebody else in mind, but that was kind of our first finished puppet. I don't even think Slimer sculpts had been started yet. I could be wrong. You know, that was again. There was just so much going on all the time. Okay. Yeah, but. They gave me a chance to show them what I could do. I helped audition the puppeteers that ended up being inside. So, you know, I gave them check marks and told Steven, Stewart, and Randy, who I thought looked like what they were doing, and they had their opinions, and they made their choices of those people. And Ron Harrison ended up getting to go back and do a lot more of the puppetry because Tim, Terry, and I were all building at that point, and Ron wasn't on the crew as a builder. So he lucked out. He ended up getting many weeks of doing Terror Dogs in the apartment set, in the hallway. Anything that would have been a full-size Terror Dog would have been to his credit. So, luckily, he was a big guy like me. I think he's 6'6", 2". So and that kind of helped to have a little bit of extra to, you know, power the rubber to get it to do what it needed to do. So.
Yeah. I really... I'm grateful to have this moment and hear all these stories. Like, I'm just doing the math like Tom. I'm like, wow, so Terror Dogs before Slimer.
Yeah.
And I think they're one of the most underappreciated creatures in Ghostbusters. But then hearing about Thriller and all these other things, Mark, we are just so grateful for your time. We're so grateful for your work and your commitment to bringing our childhood films to life and creating all these characters, and just again grateful for your time, and we're thankful that you're allowing us, because our goal at the Containment Unit is to help as many fans add to their Containment Unit, to their collection, authentic autographs from Ghostbusters cast and crew. And so there's a lot of pieces that we absolutely need you on. So thank you for being willing to participate in a signing, and we're excited to roll out some amazing new trading cards from our friend Ray Gunn and another project piece and so much more. So we're just grateful that you're choosing and allowing us to work with you.
Well, thank you so much. You know, as I feel fortunate that I had a career that I was very passionate about, a chance to do stuff that was recorded by the best camera people and camera crews on the world. And to be able to share that stuff still today and then even into the future. And just very grateful to be able to share some of that excitement and some of the fun. I know it's something that a lot of people said, hey, maybe I would like to have done that as a career. It was fun. I guarantee you, if you could have done it when it was hot and heavy, it was a real thrill to be able to bring those characters to life and to not only perform them, but to help build them, to figure out the nuts and bolts, to take rubber, sticks, string, mechanics, and to bring something alive on screen from a design. So very fortunate and just thrilled to be able to share it with you guys.
And Mark, you know, we love talking with you, love spending time with you. You're a great guy. And I hope that people watching this, if you see Mark at a local con, go say hi. He's let's talk about him like he's not here, but one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And yeah. So generous at this time. And Mark, we really, really truly thank you for, you know, giving your time to the fans and sharing time with us this afternoon.
Terrific. And I also wanted to share a little moment. Maybe everybody doesn't know, but we do hang out occasionally. So
that's it.
I love it. We were right. I was so excited when you posted the Photoshop version. I was like, "Look, we got Photoshop work done by Mark Brian Wilson."
Yeah, what a lot of fun! Looking forward to the next time getting to hang out with you guys.
Of course,
absolutely.
You too, Mark. All right. Well, take care, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Thank you.
Are you troubled by autograph forgeries online? Do you collect spores, molds, and Ghostbusters memorabilia? Have you or your family been looking for a safe place to go to add to your collection? If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Check out the Containment Unit on Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at ghostbustersautographs.com.